Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Candace. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop update on neuroendocrine tumors. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in this topic today that we have so many of you on the call today. We have 453 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, India, and the United Kingdom. So a bit of a global call as well. And we are very delighted that all of you are on the call today. It really demonstrates that you're all information seekers. You want to get as much information as possible. Now, today's program is supported by Novartis Oncology and Pfizer, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today and also for their collaborative partnership in making this program and support in making this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Arvind Dasari. Dr. Dasari is Assistant Professor, Department of Gastrointestinal GI Medical Oncology, Division of Cancer Medicine, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Dasari is going to first of all present an overview of neuroendocrine tumors, and he's going to focus then on neuroendocrine tumors of the gastrointestinal tract and pancreas. He's going to discuss diagnosis and staging, treatment options, including targeted therapies and clinical trials, and tips to manage symptoms, side effects, and pain. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Dasari.
Thank you very much, Dr. Messner, for that kind introduction and for this opportunity to be part of this a great panel of speakers. And thank you all for joining us today. As Dr. Messner mentioned, I'll start off with an overview of neuroendocrine tumors and then focus on a neuroendocrine tumor starting in the gastrointestinal tract and pancreas. And I'll use this subgroup to discuss the diagnosis and staging of neuroendocrine tumors, and then discuss the treatment options for neuroendocrine tumors starting in these sites. So neuroendocrine tumors were initially described over 100 years ago, and since then they have gained increasing attention. They are thought to arise from the diffuse neuroendocrine system in the body. So there are special cells called neuroendocrine cells distributed throughout the body, and these tumors arise from these special subgroup of cells. So essentially, they could arise from any part of the body. When you look at the incidence trends of neuroendocrine tumors, so incidence is the number of new cases noted per year. And when you look at the trend of incidence of these tumors over the past few decades, what we find is that the rate of incidence has in fact increased. According to some studies, it's estimated that the incidence has increased by about 500% in the past 30 to 35 years. Currently, it is estimated that there are about 5 to 7 new cases per 100,000 people every year in the United States. And within the group of gastrointestinal cancers, in fact, neuroendocrine tumors are the second most prevalent cancer. So prevalence is the number of individuals who are alive and affected by the cancer. So it's the second most prevalent gastrointestinal cancer after colon cancer. Like I mentioned just a minute ago, these tumors can arise from any part of the body. About one-third arise somewhere in the chest, and about two-thirds arise somewhere in the abdomen. And this is the subgroup that I'll be talking about over the next few minutes. So the tumors that arise in the abdomen arise somewhere in the gastrointestinal tract or the pancreas. It's important to make a distinction between the neuroendocrine tumors arising in the pancreas or pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors versus neuroendocrine tumors arising elsewhere in the gastrointestinal tract. Because the subgroup of patients that arise in the gastrointestinal tract outside of the pancreas have a distinct behavior compared to those arising in the pancreas. The pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors tend to behave differently and tend to respond differently to treatments. We'll go over those aspects in detail in just a couple of minutes. Moving on to the diagnosis and staging of these tumors. So when we see a patient with a diagnosis of or a suspected diagnosis of neuroendocrine tumors, the questions that we ask are, is the tumor functional? Is the tumor producing any hormones that could cause symptoms related to the neuroendocrine tumors? So neuroendocrine tumors arising outside the pancreas, typically in the small intestine, produce a hormone called serotonin that causes a constellation of symptoms, most commonly flushing, diarrhea, and less commonly, it could cause abdominal cramping and also affect the heart, causing heart disease called carcinoid heart disease. In addition, they could rarely affect the skin and also the central nervous system. The neuroendocrine tumors arising in the pancreas could also similarly produce hormones, but however, these are the hormones that are typically produced by the pancreas, but in the case of pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors arising in the pancreas, these are produced in excess. So patients could have an excess production of insulin or glucagon, which are hormones that typically regulate the glucose metabolism in the body. Rarely, they could also produce other hormones called gastrin, somatostatin, and so on. Not every patient with a neuroendocrine tumor produces these hormones in excess. Depending on which study you look at, anywhere from 30 to 60% of patients with a diagnosis of neuroendocrine tumors may produce these hormones. So that's the first thing that we ask about whether the tumor is functional or not, whether it's producing hormones or not. The second question that we ask is the grade of the tumor. So that is something that we evaluate in a piece of the tumor tissue under the microscope. So essentially what we're trying to do here is to get an estimate of how quickly the tumor is growing and spreading. So we do that by looking at a certain protein called Ki67, which is only produced in cells that are dividing or multiplying. And we also can do this by counting the number of cells that are actually undergoing cell division under the microscope. That's called a mitotic index. And depending on that, depending on the extent of expression of Ki67 or the mitotic index, these tumors can be subdivided into subgroups, so low-grade, intermediate-grade, or high-grade, depending on the rate of proliferation. Low-grade and intermediate-grade neuroendocrine tumors, for the most part, are treated and managed in an identical fashion and are together grouped under well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors. High-grade neuroendocrine tumors are poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinomas, and they're treated in a completely different fashion, which we will not be discussing today. So that's the second piece of information we want to get in addition to the functional status or hormone production. The second thing is the grade or the differentiation of the tumor. The third aspect that we want to find out is the stage of the tumor. That is, how far has the tumor spread in the body? Where has it started and how far has it spread? And neuroendocrine tumors, for the most part, are staged according to the so-called TNM staging. So this is very similar to how other more common cancers, such as breast cancer, colon cancer, or lung cancer, are staged. So mostly into four stages, one being early, four being late. And this is this information is obtained mostly by doing scans and sometimes by doing endoscopies. The scans that are done could be MRI scans or they could be CT scans. Neuroendocrine tumors are also staged using a special scan called an octreotide scan or octreo scan. There is a more modern and a better iteration of the octreo scan called the gallium scan, which is not yet widely available here in the United States, but is rapidly gaining attention and acceptance within the community. So this is as far as the diagnosis and staging of neuroendocrine tumor tumors go. So briefly, we want to look at the functional status of the tumor, the grade of the tumor, and the stage of the tumor. Now, we use this information to make treatment decisions in a discussion with the patients and their families. If a patient has a tumor that has not spread to other parts of the body, and if it is in a location and a stage where we are able to do surgery to remove it completely and safely, then that would be our option. Even in patients in whom the tumor has spread to other parts of the body, we always want to see if we're able to do surgery to remove all the tumor spots safely and completely. So these patients who have tumors that can be removed with surgery or they have resectable tumors, undergo surgery. And then after surgery, they are monitored for possible recurrence of the tumor for up to 7 to 10 years with blood work, scans, and endoscopies as needed, done every 6 to 12 months. In patients in whom, because of the location and or distribution of the tumors, the tumors cannot be removed safely with surgery, so-called unresectable tumors, in those patients, we look at other treatment options. Now, while trying to make those treatment decisions, the things that we, again, look at are is the tumor-producing hormones that is causing symptoms for the patients. In that case, if the patient does have symptoms related to hormone production, then we initiate treatment with a class of drugs called somatostatin analogs. So they're called somatostatin analogs because they're very similar to a hormone that is produced naturally in the body called somatostatin. And what this hormone does is that it goes and binds to certain proteins on the surface of the cancer cells and shuts down and interacts with the pathways within these cancer cells that produce these hormones, essentially helps with those symptoms. So all patients with symptoms suggestive of hormone production should be started on one of these somatostatin analogs. And there are currently two such drugs available in the market and widely used. One is called octreotide or sandostatin. The other is called lanreotide or somatulin. Depending on availability, the site of origin of the tumor, and other factors, one versus the other drug can be used. Now, what we also look at is in patients in whom there is no hormone production, the next question that we ask is, can we monitor the patients closely without doing any treatment, or should we start some form of treatment immediately? Because what we know is that neuroendocrine tumors, especially the well-differentiated kind, tend to be very slow-growing. And patients could go a long time without requiring any treatment. So we need to make a decision as to whether we need to we can follow the path of monitoring patients closely versus initiating treatment immediately. Now, how do we make that those decisions? Again, we go back to the information that we got at the time of diagnosis and staging. So looking at the grade of the tumor, so is it a low grade or intermediate grade? So that kind of gives us an idea of potentially how quickly the tumor could grow and spread. And we also look at the amount of tumor that the patient has had at the time of diagnosis, again, the staging of the tumor. So in patients in whom we're concerned that perhaps the tumors could grow and spread sooner than in other patients, or in other patients in whom we're concerned that even by the time of diagnosis, the tumor has spread and grown significantly. In those patients, we tend to initiate treatment without monitoring for tumor growth and progression first. So in these patients, again, the two drugs that we discussed, the somatostatin analogs, octreotide and lanreotide, would be good options. Because these drugs, by interacting with the proteins on the surface of the cell, not only inhibit hormone production, but also inhibit further tumor growth and spread. So those would be very good options to consider, especially in frontline therapy for these patients, and have been kind of the first line options for a lot of patients with neuroendocrine tumors, for both for hormone control as well as tumor control. In other patients, recently the FDA approved a drug called everolimus or Afinitor, which is a pill that patients take every day. And it works by acting on a protein called mTOR that is important for the cancer cells to grow and spread. And this pill is effective in preventing further growth and spread of these tumors. And this pill has been approved by the FDA for neuroendocrine tumors arising in all parts of the body. Now, these are the options that are available for gastrointestinal neuroendocrine tumors, irrespective of where they're starting, whether it's in the pancreas or whether it's outside of the pancreas. Now, we also briefly discussed that pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors tend to be somewhat different from other gastrointestinal neuroendocrine tumors. These tumors actually tend to respond to conventional chemotherapy drugs, and these are drugs that do not appear to have a whole lot of activity in neuroendocrine tumors arising in other parts of the gastrointestinal tract. An old drug called ceftazocin, and it was in fact the first FDA-approved drug for pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. So that is sometimes used, but it is given IV and may have some side effects. So more recently, although not FDA approved, a lot of physicians taking care of pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors have used other chemotherapy drugs, especially a certain drug called temozolomide, with or without another oral drug called capecitabine. There is actually an ongoing large trial that is trying to definitively show that these drugs in fact have activity. But what we know from extensive experience is that pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors tend to respond to these sort of drugs. So that is one option for patients with pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. Another option is a drug called sunitinib or Sutent, which is again a chemotherapy pill that patients take by mouth every day. And this drug and this class of drugs have also been used in the treatment of multiple other cancers. So thus, a drug works by preventing the neuroendocrine tumors from forming new blood vessels and is currently FDA approved for pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. Now, whether this class of drugs have activity in other neuroendocrine tumors is being investigated currently. The last year to 2 years have been a very exciting time for the neuroendocrine community, both for physicians as well as patients. There's been an extensive amount of research and some very exciting results. Perhaps the one treatment that everybody is very excited about is a treatment called PRRT, or peptide receptor radionuclide therapy. So this is, again, a treatment that essentially targets the same receptors that octreotide or lanreotide bind to or attach to. These are the somatostatin receptors. So the way this treatment works, to put it in very simple terms, is that they take a molecule that's very similar to octreotide or lanreotide, and then they attach this molecule to another molecule that can emit radiation, and this is given IV. And so this molecule goes and sits on the, attaches itself to the cancer cells and then delivers radiation to the cancer cells. And this has been used for a long time in Europe. And more recently in North America, there was a large trial that showed that it was very effective in patients with small bowel or small intestinal neuroendocrine tumors whose tumors had stopped responding to octreotide or lanreotide. So this clinical trial has generated a lot of excitement, and this data is actually at the FDA being reviewed is pending approval. The FDA has until the end of the year to make a final decision. Another drug, recently had very positive outcomes, is a drug called telotrestat, which is a pill that inhibits the enzyme that produces serotonin, and the hormone that causes carcinoid syndrome, flushing, diarrhea, and also affects the heart. So this pill inhibits a certain enzyme that's important for the cancer cells to produce serotonin, and helps control carcinoid syndrome symptoms for these patients. Similar to PRRT, this data is also at the FDA, and the FDA has until February to review this data and make a final decision. So that, in a nutshell, is an introduction to neuroendocrine tumors, our general approach to the management, and recent developments in this field. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Dasari. That was really excellent and incredibly comprehensive and, I think, very informative to all of our participants. And I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. Really wonderful. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Patrick Ford. Dr. Ford is Assistant Professor of Oncology, Johns Hopkins, Sydney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Ford is going to be addressing an overview of neuroendocrine tumors of the lung, diagnosis and staging, and key questions to ask your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Ford.
Hey, thank you, Carolyn. Welcome to you all, and thanks to Cancer Care for inviting me to speak on the topic of neuroendocrine tumors of the lung. Just briefly to talk about tumors which arise in the lung in general, when we think of lung cancer, we generally speaking, most people think of a different type of lung cancer, non-small cell lung cancer or small cell lung cancer. Today, the topic we're talking about in general is neuroendocrine tumors, and specifically neuroendocrine tumors of the lung in my case. And these, in comparison to commoner lung cancers, as many of you will be aware, these are relatively rare. These make up about 1 to 2% of all lung cancers which arise in in adults. And as Dr. Amdasari mentioned, these make up roughly one quarter of neuroendocrine tumors. So one quarter of neuroendocrine tumors arise in the thorax or in the chest. When we see, when we talk about neuroendocrine tumors of the lung, there are two main types, and they have a slightly different way of referring to them or naming them when they arise in the chest. Atypical tumors are tumors which tend to grow a little bit faster, and typical tumors are more indolent or low-grade tumors. And this is similar to as Dr. Amdasari mentioned in the GI, the low-grade designation and the intermediate grade designation. So low grade would refer to a typical tumor, a typical neuroendocrine tumor, and intermediate grade would be analogous to an atypical tumor. In terms of how patients and how people are initially diagnosed with these tumors, frequently patients may report a wheeze or a cough. The other common presenting symptom can be coughing up blood, which obviously can be distressing and worrying and drives people to go to seek medical attention from their doctor or from the emergency room. The other point to keep in mind is that many patients who develop neuroendocrine tumors of the lung are not smokers. There is a very unclear association between smoking and neuroendocrine tumors of the lung, which is much less strongly associated with neuroendocrine tumors than with other types of lung cancer. The overall frequency of neuroendocrine tumors, as I said, is not common in the lung. It's roughly about 0.5 to 1.5 per 100,000 people per year. So as you can imagine, it's not a very common tumor, and that leads to challenges for patients who are diagnosed in terms of getting information about these tumors from their doctors who may not have seen a similar case in the past, and also from their peers in terms of not confusing these tumors with other types of commoner lung cancers. So as I said, a way that many people present with these tumors is either with a wheeze, either with coughing up blood, or sometimes purely picked up on a chest x-ray performed for another reason, so either for a work physical or for chest pain or for some other reason to have a chest x-ray, a nodule is noted by the doctor on the chest x-ray and it leads to investigations. The two types of neuroendocrine tumors which I mentioned, typical and atypical, in general, typical tumors tend to be more common, approximately 3 to 4 times as common as the higher grade atypical tumors. And the way that tumors behave is different as well. So typical tumors in general are less likely to have spread to other areas at the time of diagnosis. They're less likely to have involved the lymph nodes in the middle of the chest or that lands in the middle of the chest in terms of spreading from the lung to those lands at the time of diagnosis. And they tend to be more amenable to treatments like surgery or rarely radiation therapy. Atypical tumors, on the other hand, tend to have a bit more likely to spread to other organs or to spread to lymph nodes in the middle of the chest. The staging of them, however, is similar in terms of how we work out what the stage of the cancer is. To go back a little bit, looking at how we diagnose these cancers, and it's done by usually by getting a sample of the tumor. This can be obtained in the chest by doing a bronchoscopy procedure where a lung doctor sedates the patient and puts a tube down the throat with a camera at the end and takes a biopsy of the nodule. This is performed for tumors which are central in the middle of the chest. For nodules which are more peripheral or at the outside of the lung, sometimes a needle core biopsy can be performed using CT guidance, using radiologic guidance. Neither of those procedures can be performed to try and get a sample of the tumor. It's then sent to pathology, and the pathologist looks at the specimen. The diagnosis of the specimen is different, again, in neuroendocrine tumors of the lung compared to GI tumors, in that we don't tend to specifically use the Ki-67 index, which Dr. Amdasari mentioned in the lung tumors. Instead, we look at the number of mitoses, or the number of cells which are dividing in the specimen. If there's two or less cells dividing, then it's classified as a typical tumor. If there's between 2 and 10 cells dividing within a certain amount of the tumor when the pathologist looks down the microscope, then it's considered an atypical tumor. There is one other thing which can make it an atypical tumor, and that's if when the pathologist looks at the specimen, some of the cells are necrotic or are not alive at the time when the specimen is examined. Just to briefly mention, so if there are more than 10 cells dividing per 50 hypertrophy yields or within a certain amount of the tumor examined, then the tumor is generally considered a different type of lung cancer, either small cell lung cancer or large cell neuroendocrine cancer. And those are high-grade neuroendocrine tumors, which I'm not going to talk further about today. So once the patient has a diagnosis of neuroendocrine tumors of the lung, then the staging takes place. And that, in most cases, involves a CAT scan of the chest and usually involving the upper abdomen as well. The CAT scan gives images of the chest, gives images usually of the liver and also of the adrenal glands. And the radiologist is looking at the lungs to see, is there one nodule, are there multiple nodules, or are the lymph nodes in the middle of the chest enlarged? The radiologist is also looking at the liver to see if there's any evidence of the cancer spreading to that area, and also at the adrenal glands, which is another place where lung tumors can spread to. If there's any specific symptoms the patient has in terms of headaches or any other neurological symptoms, especially for the atypical type of lung tumor, the oncologist or the doctor may recommend doing a scan of the brain. Frequently for lung cancers in general, and because these cancers are picked up usually by lung doctors, patients may have a PET scan, which is a form of scan which involves injecting a radioactive tracer into the patient, which goes to areas where cells are dividing and can go to areas of cancer and give an accurate picture as to whether areas such as lymph nodes have cancer in them. As well, specific to neuroendocrine tumors arising in the lung, sometimes a patient during the bronchoscopy procedure will have the lymph nodes in the middle of his chest sampled to see if those contain any cancer cells. And this can guide whether the patient's tumor is amenable to surgery or not, or whether other therapies might be indicated. So once the patient's cancer has been staged, so the staging classification is usually and there are two components to it, and it's actually the same classification we use for the commoner types of lung cancer, non-small cell lung cancer. The staging is based on the size of the tumor, whether the lymph nodes in the middle of the chest or in the neck are involved, or whether the tumor has spread to other organs. And those categorizations are TNM, tumor, node, and metastasis, the size of the primary tumor, whether lymph nodes are involved or not, and whether the tumor has metastasized to other areas. Within that, and depending on what TNM stage the tumor is, it is also given a classification of between stage 1 to 4. I think Dr. Lee is going to talk a little bit about treatment options for these cancers. Briefly, I will mention that depending on what the stage of the cancer is, in many cases, lung neuroendocrine tumors are treated with surgical resection, and probably the majority of these tumors end up being resected by lung surgeons. If the tumor has spread to other areas in the body, then the patient will likely be referred to an oncologist for advice on systemic treatments. The other aspect of treatment I was asked to address was key questions to ask your healthcare team about quality of life. And I think there are certain things which I mentioned in terms of when a patient presents with these tumors. Sometimes they may be coughing up blood, but that is usually easy to deal with, either with a surgical treatment or sometimes via bronchoscopy. And it's usually not life-threatening with these types of cancers. However, it's obviously very distressing. if a patient does have surgery for their cancer, then as with any surgery, and especially with surgeries to the chest, there is some recovery time afterwards, and it's helpful to ask your surgeon what to expect from the surgery and what the recovery time is likely to be. And that will vary a little bit depending on your general health. And then one thing which Dr. Basari mentioned was carcinoid syndrome, which is where the tumor secretes hormones or chemicals into the bloodstream which cause symptoms such as flushing or diarrhea or other symptoms related to those hormones in the bloodstream. This syndrome is a little bit less common with neuroendocrine tumors arising in the lung, however, can happen. And the treatments which Dr. Basari mentioned in terms of somatostatin analogs can be very helpful in this regard. Also helpful if there's any evidence of the tumor having spread outside the lung can be to consider doing the octreotide scan, which I think Dr. Basari also mentioned, which can tell us whether the tumor is expressing these somatostatin receptors and might benefit from treatment with a somatostatin analog injection. So at that point, I think I'll pass on to Dr. Lee, and he's going to address the treatment options for lung neuroendocrine tumors.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Ford. That was excellent and really very informative, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Bob Lee. Dr. Lee is a medical oncologist, thoracic oncology service, developmental therapeutics, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Dr. Lee is going to address treatment options, targeted therapies, and clinical trials for neuroendocrine tumors of the lung, tips to manage symptoms, side effects, and pain, and follow-up care plans. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Lee.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you to Cancer Care for inviting me to this workshop to provide some information for patients and their families. So I will build on from what Drs. Basari and Dr. Ford had outlined, build on the treatment options for neuroendocrine tumors, and also touch on some specifics on management of symptoms and pain, side effects to improve quality of life. So as Dr. Ford had already explained in very good detail, that the comprehensive diagnosis is very, very important in the management of these diseases. It not only the diagnosis of neuroendocrine tumor has to be made, but also the location, the size, the stage of the tumor, and also the grading of the tumor, including incorporating mitotic figures. These are really fine details that the pathologist will provide to the patient's oncologist, and also molecular imaging markers that Dr. Ford also mentioned. So with all that, that has to be all done together. And once a comprehensive diagnosis is reached, then the first question to ask is this disease curable or not? And if it is curable, that is, you generally early stage diseases, and then the treatment of choice, as Dr. Ford also mentioned, is primarily surgery. We want the tumor to be cut out if it can, if it is localized to one single area. And so surgery being the predominant modality of treatment for early stage neuroendocrine tumors of the lung, there are other techniques employed for local therapy, and that includes radiotherapy as well, and sometimes ablative techniques through interventional radiology as well. These are so-called local therapies for neuroendocrine tumors. Now, if the disease is more advanced, so the stage is more advanced, the disease has spread from one place to another in the body to lymph nodes, the opposite lung, to liver, to bone, and to other organs, then this is termed advanced neuroendocrine tumors that surgery alone or surgery would not be the treatment of choice. And in this case, local therapy still plays a role in one, it could improve a local disease control, and including towards the liver in terms of liver metastasis. There are radiologic techniques that can be done to control liver metastasis, including radioembolization and chemoembolization techniques. But those are aimed at controlling disease, prolonging life, and also hope quality of life as well. But the mainstay of treatment for advanced stage neuroendocrine tumors would fall into the umbrella of systemic therapy. Systemic therapies need, there are now, thanks to a lot of research breakthroughs in the last decade, we have now a multitude of systemic therapy options for patients. This really depends on the finer details of the tumor, the grading, the mitotic counts that Dr. Ford had explained, and also molecular imaging markers. They fall into targeted therapies. Now, Dr. Desari also mentioned, similar to the treatment of gastrointestinal neuroendocrine tumors, somatostatin analogs as a class of treatment agents are commonly used to control carcinoid symptoms. Those are hormonal related symptoms related to neuroendocrine tumors, including hot flashes, diarrhea, wheezing. These are typically controlled with somatostatin analog. These are injections. Octreotide, lanreotide are examples of these drugs that are given either intramuscularly or subcutaneously up the buttock or on the tummy under the skin once every 4 weeks in general as a standard treatment. And recent research has also shown that these not only control symptoms of neuroendocrine tumors, the carcinoid symptoms, but also helps with slowing down the growth of the tumor and controlling the disease from spreading and from growing. So those are an important class of agents used at treating these diseases. There are some newer drugs, Dr. We also touched upon earlier that everolimus or Afinitor is also a an effective agent that can be used to treat neuroendocrine tumors of the lung also. Dr. Desari mentioned that they are effective for gastrointestinal and pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, but also for pulmonary neuroendocrine tumors. Those are useful. These are pills that you take once a day. One particular side effect is a common side effect is the development of mouth ulcers. And Memorial Sloan Kettering, we typically use steroid-containing mouthwashes for patients. And recently there was a randomized control trial that showed that this approach has led to the reduction of mouth ulcers. So this is a typical supportive measure that we use. A helpful tip for many patients that they can do that to prevent such side effects that could be very unpleasant. There are a number of other agents, including sunitinib, and also Dr. Desari mentioned a peptide receptor radionuclide therapy (PRRT). That are very, very, very promising, mainly in the form of clinical trials at the moment, pending FDA decisions in the future. And those are newer therapies that are very promising, and we certainly encourage patients with neuroendocrine tumors to talk to their oncologist about the availability in terms of clinical trials that may be suitable for patients. So these are, just as a nutshell, these are radiologic nuclear medicine treatments that are given intravenously. Eligible patients need to have a gallium PET scan first, and if the tumors take up the peptide, then the one can label a molecule with a radioactive substance such as lutetium and injected by vein. It's usually given every several weeks, such as every 8 weeks, and for a fixed number of doses, such as 4, and they have been shown to be very effective in terms of delivering high-dose radioactive substance directly into the neuroendocrine tumors and kill the tumor cells from within through targeted radiation. So that's called PRRT. So, and there are more and more drugs coming in, more and more new agents coming in through the clinical trial. So whenever a clinical trial is available, I would highly encourage patients to participate and get access to newer therapies. Chemotherapy is still a treatment option. It also depends on the biology of this tumor. So one combination being temozolomide and capecitabine. They are still being conducted in the context of clinical trials, and they are generally for well-differentiated or low to intermediate-grade neuroendocrine tumors. These are also termed carcinoid tumors, where the typical or atypical, if you hear the term carcinoid, it's really, we're talking about the same thing. We're talking about low-grade to intermediate-grade neuroendocrine tumors for the lung. Now, there are also the higher-grade end of the spectrum for neuroendocrine tumors, and one would also call them neuroendocrine carcinomas. These are really high-grade tumors, and other chemotherapy agents such as platinum, etoposide, are commonly used for high-grade neuroendocrine tumors or poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinomas. So, again, I come to clinical trials. If one is available, I would certainly encourage patients to participate. And there are newer therapies, including immune checkpoint therapies, that have been very promising across a number of other solid tumors, but now also being looked at in neuroendocrine tumors to really aimed at revving up your immune system to attack the cancer from within. In terms of just a few points on symptom management, so patients with neuroendocrine tumors can have so-called carcinoid syndrome or carcinoid symptoms. Those are hormonally related symptoms, hot flashes, diarrhea, wheezing. Again, somatostatin analogs are the treatment of choice. These are injections to the buttock or to the abdomen, and your oncologist will be able to adjust the dosing, the frequency according to the symptoms to get it under control. So typically it's one dose every 4 weeks, but certainly it's a variable patient to patient. One can develop pain when the neuroendocrine tumor spreads from one place to another, and I do want to make a point that cancer pain can be controlled, can be well managed, can be eliminated by good medicine, good supportive medicines. So there are a wide range of medicines we can use to eliminate pain, and this includes simple analgesia such as acetaminophen, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, and we also can increase and add on additional agents such as specialized opiate medications, opiate analgesia, or narcotic analgesia to be prescribed by your oncologist or palliative care specialist. So most from my practice, pretty much most of the vast majority of cancer pain is very, very well controlled, and pretty much all the pain can be alleviated. And also other techniques can be used to improve pain, such as back to the concept of local therapy, radiation therapy, for example, for bone pain, for bone metastasis, can be very, very effective in this circumstance. There are side effects and other symptoms related to treatment, to medications, including hand-foot syndrome, particularly if a patient is on sunitinib, and those really need good supportive care, including lots of moisturizers for the hands and feet, and also some additional urea-based cream have been shown to be pretty fairly effective in this instance as well. So there are topical measures, creams, ointments that can be used to prevent and to alleviate symptoms. Mouth ulcers I've already touched on. Steroid-containing mouthwashes are highly effective in preventing mouth ulcers and also treating the onset of mouth ulcers. So all in all, the treatments, systemic treatments, are really aimed at prolonging patient's life so that the patient can go back and live their normal life and to go back to do whatever they like to do on a day-to-day basis and also to have good quality of life at the same time. And we hope with more research and more clinical trial and clinical trial participation, we can make further breakthroughs to help the lives of many patients. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lee. That was really excellent and a lot of wonderful information. Also really focus on managing treatment side effects, quality of life. Excellent. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Liz Ezra. Ms. Ezra is an oncology social worker. She's our program coordinator for pancreatic programs here at Cancer Care, and she is going to address with you the Cancer Care's three psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Ezra.
Thank you, Carolyn. I am happy to be part of this important call today. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with neuroendocrine tumors and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs include individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. And these services are all provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through similar situation or have similar problems. These connections can help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your fears and your concerns. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. So at this time, Cancer Care has many telephone and online support groups. Cancer Care can also provide some practical help for some of your expenses. If you are interested in any of Cancer Care's services, please call our helpline at 1-800-813-4673 or on our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of additional information on your cancer diagnosis and the treatment you need to receive. As we have learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Oh, thanks so much, Liz, and thanks for letting everyone know about all the services they can access from Cancer Care. And now we have time for questions, and I'm going to ask Candace to bring all of our speakers on board, and then if Candace would explain to the audience how to queue up for questions. We're going to try to take a few of your questions, and then any questions we don't get to, I'm going to let you know how to get your questions answered. So, but let's see how many of your questions we can actually take right now. So, Candace?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, to ask a question at this time, please press star 1.
We have a question from one of our online participants, from Kendra, and I'm going to ask Dr. Lee if you could address this question. I'm going to try to summarize it briefly. Again, I'm going to ask Dr. Lee to address your question in a general way, and then, of course, we ask you to go back to your treating healthcare team.
Sure.
So I had a calcium score scan done in March, which showed an irregular nodule in my lung. I had a left lower lobectomy, and it was a stage 1B, poorly differentiated grade 3. I received cisplatin and etoposide every 3 weeks for 6 cycles. I noted that the path report showed visceral pleura invasion, but my oncologist didn't find this. I had to tell her. So the question is that she is being treated as a small cell disease with poor differentiation, and the caller is a healthcare professional, and I can't help but think that there may be something missing. So the issue is getting a second opinion in terms of a specialist in neuroendocrine cancers, and I wondered if Dr. Lee, if you could address, this is a complicated question, but it may be a question that people are wondering about if it's being treated for one thing and what if it's something else. And so I think that comes up in a lot of our calls. If there's just some general guidelines you can provide for people, also a resource where no matter where they are in the country, they may be able to find a specialist in their particular type of cancer.
Sure, thank you. So I will just mention that the neuroendocrine tumors are actually an incredibly complex set of diseases, and it ranges from low-grade typical carcinoids to high-grade neuroendocrine carcinomas and sometimes small cell lung cancers in their biology. And this is really an evolving, these terminologies have come from the last more than 100 years of evolving research, as Dr. Dasari had mentioned in his introduction of this disease. Now, small cell lung cancers are really the high-grade end of neuroendocrine tumors, and they do not fall into the large category of low to intermediate grade neuroendocrine tumors or the carcinoid tumors. So these small cell lung cancers need to be treated, even with neuroendocrine features, need to be treated separately as really the on the high grade side, and that's really it's a separate entity, and that's small cell lung cancers, which is different to the carcinoids. And certainly any patient, if there are areas of concern, is entitled to seek a second opinion and get another sense of the specifics, and that includes a second opinion on pathology diagnosis, pathology confirmation. Many institutions can also provide that, a second opinion by the pathologist to look at the diagnosis of small cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, whether that is actually accurate, correct, whether grading was performed, the mitosis, whether the pathology actually matches. Those things are performed at many institutions, including at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and certainly the patient is entitled to seek such reassurances. But from just in general, in terms of treating small cell lung cancers with chemotherapy, and I did mention platinum etoposide being the standard of care for high-grade neuroendocrine carcinomas or small cell cancer, lung cancer, is entirely appropriate.
Excellent. Thank you. And I have one other question, which I know comes up a lot on our calls. Sometimes people are far away from a comprehensive, an NCI-designated comprehensive center. If you could say a word about that, and also that those centers are often available kind of virtually or to call them on the telephone and to kind of work with them and your healthcare team to find who is there an expert around that they could see or that they could, if it's a reasonable path report, can that be sent or how? Just the logistics of that, because I think that often is challenging to people in different parts of the country. And if you can just make a general statement about that. So I
will give you my take from Memorial Sloan Kettering, where I see patients, both local patients in New York, but also around the globe internationally who come from afar. And the care coordination can be fairly complex for these patients who travel from afar. At MSK, we do, at Memorial Sloan Kettering, we do offer, and I know many other institutions do the same, in terms of, firstly, a pathologic second opinion diagnosis. So a patient, through their local primary oncologist and local pathologist, can organize the biopsy or the surgical biopsy tissue to be sent to an outside academic institution for confirmation of diagnosis. And certainly at MSK, pathologists, our pathology services service offers that that service basically, and to have our MSK pathologists take a look and go through a lot of the comprehensive markers that that Dr. Dasari and Dr. Ford had spoken about, the grading, the mitotic counts of the tumors, and the Ki-67, etc. So that can be done for a lot of patients who cannot physically come to Memorial Sloan Kettering, but do want to seek a second opinion because there are doubts about the pathologic diagnosis. Now, some patients would also like to get their opinion on treatment or their care. So I do see a lot of patients every week traveling from afar, sometimes catching a plane from Asia, from Europe. It could come to New York City, and then it may be a once-off consultation, and then patients, of course, like to go back home, and we offer a consultation, a second opinion, and a report in writing. And I would always encourage the patient to go back to their primary local oncologist. Patients must be able to connect with a local oncologist whom they trust. And from my practice, whenever the patient comes to see me, I would always encourage the patient to give me the authorization and the release to be able to send the record to the primary local oncologist so that such care, the patient's care, can be comprehensively coordinated. My opinions may be able to be transmitted to the local oncologist, and I'm always, and I'm sure many oncologists across different centers, and pretty much all of us are happy to pick up the phone and speak to the patient's local oncologist. So in that case, I would serve as an ancillary role, or in the back seat, so to speak. I would provide my opinion based on what I see and what I find, but really take it back to the local oncologist for consideration. But it's the local oncologist who would continue to take care of the patient on the day-to-day basis, depending on the actual clinical circumstances. And medicine is never good to be done in a remote control fashion. So I would provide my assessment and my recommendation based on that consultation at that time, but the follow-up is best done, of course, close to home, where because really patients with cancers, their lives have to continue. You have to keep living. You're not tied to a particular hospital for the rest of your life. You need to continue living and find a care center, a healthcare center where you can be taken care of while you continue to live your life. So that's generally the approach I take when managing patients coming from afar.
Excellent, thank you. I hope that's helpful to everybody. And I will give this number at the end, but I'm going to mention again that the National Cancer Institute is a wonderful resource for finding the centers that are near you or to get their phone numbers, information. So the National Cancer Institute number is 1-800-422-6237 or www.cancer.gov, and you'll all be getting that information in the materials you get from us after the call, kind of the wrap-ups. You'll be getting that these resources as well. There's one last. Oh, yes.
Just briefly to add, it's Patrick Ford here. The Carcinoid Foundation has some very good links on their website for patients to find out local oncologists, so within their state, who have an interest in carcinoid tumors in general, and many of those physicians will be very experienced in pulmonary carcinoids and lung carcinoids. Also, in terms of the small cell lung cancer, there are a number of lung cancer patient advocacy groups like Longevity or the National Lung Cancer Partnership who can provide a lot of very useful information online and also over the phone to patients.
These are excellent resources, everybody. So the Carcinoid Foundation, Longevity, we actually have a relationship with them, so we will send you that information as well. And the third one, Dr. Ford?
Yeah, so the Free to Breathe, I believe they're called now.
Oh, Free to Breathe, oh yes, okay, Free to Breathe, yes, okay, so we'll have that information to send to all of you as well.
The Carcinoid Foundation is just carcinoid.org. So.
Excellent, okay. Excellent. So we will send all that to everyone as well. This is wonderful information. And then the last question we're going to take is a kind of late-breaking question, but actually there's about three or four people who are asking this question about, I'm actually going to ask Dr. Dasari if you could address it to begin with, but then I'm going to ask everyone to weigh in on before we end. It's really a question about heritability. So there are three different questions, but I'm going to read them all. Can this be passed on to my children? Should I have them screened? And then the next one is, what are the criteria for referral to a genetic counselor for genetic testing in the presence of NETs, or neuroendocrine tumors? Who should be tested? And last, is there a genetic link among neuroendocrine tumors and other cancers? My whole family has various types of cancers, and my mother has neuroendocrine tumors. So, again, it's that whether people, the heritable aspect and screening. Dr. Dasari, could you address that question in a general way? And I'll ask, actually, Dr. Ford and Dr. Lee as well to comment on that.
So there's a small minority of patients with neuroendocrine tumors who may have a genetic predisposition to developing neuroendocrine tumors. They typically have a certain syndrome called MEN1 or multiple endocrine neoplasia. So essentially what that means is that these patients and family members, because of an underlying genetic defect, are at the risk of developing tumors in multiple endocrine organs. And they typically have a constellation of symptoms related to tumors in the pituitary, parathyroid, and so on. And they are also at a risk of developing neuroendocrine tumors of the pancreas and lung, amongst other sites, also the thymus. However, this accounts for a very, very small minority, and there's typically a certain family history that points us towards this condition. And outside of this genetic syndrome, there are a couple of other rare genetic syndromes, such as VHL or von Hippel-Lindau syndrome, that again are very rarely associated with neuroendocrine tumors. Bottom line, the vast majority of neuroendocrine patients do not have an underlying genetic disposition. There's a small minority who we can usually pick up based on the characteristic family history. Now, as an aside, we know very little about the underlying causes for developing neuroendocrine tumors. The NCI is actually managing a registry of families with a family history of neuroendocrine tumors, especially those arising in the small bowel, so that is tumors that are not typically seen in the MEN1 syndrome. And so if you or your families have a history of neuroendocrine tumors arising in the small bowel, please do consider enrolling in that registry study.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Ford, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think I would just second what Dr. Dasari had to say. I think participation in clinical trials is very useful, and especially talking to your oncologist and looking at clinicaltrials.gov, which is a good resource. It generally has a listing of all clinical trials available in the United States and internationally, and being able to go online perhaps with guidance from your oncologist in terms of what would be suitable for your particular situation.
Thank you. And Dr. Lee, did you want to?
Yeah, so I fully agree with both Dr. Dasari and Dr. Ford that it's really a small proportion of neuroendocrine tumors that are known to have a genetic cause, and that's inherited genetic cause, and that is the multiple endocrine neoplasia, MEN type 1 or type 2. But the vast majority, while cancers are by definition genetic disease, they are not known to be inherited from one generation to another, and often the interplay of genetic susceptibility and environmental exposure, which we really do not understand much about. As Dr. Desari said, much work needs to be done through the NCI and beyond. And certainly if a patient who has multiple families who have neuroendocrine tumors, the same neuroendocrine tumors but in multiple generations, blood relatives, then that should be encouraged to be looked at, but in the context of a well-organized clinical research. But beyond that, I do not have anything more to add.
Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've really been outstanding. And I also want to thank everyone for staying in here a little bit longer. We did extend the call a bit because it's an important call. It's a program that we don't get to offer that often. It's important, and I know it's important to cover all the information, but also to take some of your questions. So I want to thank you all for that. I want to thank you, all of you who posed your questions online. And I also want to, of course, thank our speakers and all of you who have been listening. Now, I recognize that there are lots more questions, so I want to first of all give you a resource. If you have a question that is a medically focused question around neuroendocrine tumors, I would definitely recommend that you do call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. And we also have other resources for you to call. So the Carcinoid Foundation, Longevity, we'll send you information about all of these, and Free to Breathe. These are all advocacy groups that have also wonderful information for you and referral information as well for specific types of neuroendocrine tumors. And so this would be very helpful to everyone as well. And you will get this information after the call today. When we send you all your evaluations, there will be all these resources, additional resources listed for you. In addition, as we conclude the program today, we don't want any one of you to feel that you're alone in coping with neuroendocrine tumors of the gastrointestinal tract, pancreas, lung, or other types of cancers. We want you to know that you're now part of a cancer care community, and we're here to help you. And I think Liz identified all the different services we offer. We have oncology social workers here who are trained and available to provide you with support and counseling, support groups, practical and financial assistance and information, other workshops as well that we offer. And I do want to mention a workshop that we do have coming up on December 5th. It's called Managing Sensory Disruptions During Cancer Treatments. As you all know, if you're undergoing cancer treatment, sometimes they can affect some of your sensory, just your feeling, how you feel all the time. And so I think that might be a useful workshop for some of you, and you'll be getting information about that. Some of you have signed up for it already. So most importantly, again, as we conclude, we are simply a telephone call away, or you can visit our website for our international visitors as well, or for those who prefer visiting our website, and get your access to services from us. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may now disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.